Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Welcome to the latest global news recorded at 0300 hours GMT on Thursday, the 19th of January. I'm Komla Dumont with a selection of highlights from across BBC World Service news today. Coming up, Pakistan's government takes on the country's Supreme Court over corruption charges against President Zardari. The World Health Organization says half of all abortions carried out around the world are unsafe.
These kinds of situations are happening in large numbers where women are taking toxic substances, they're drinking cleansers, trying to end a pregnancy.
The IMF warns more money must be made available to help stabilize the world economy. And a second Russian oligarch throws his hat in the ring to challenge Vladimir Putin for president. But remember what happened last time.
The first one was attempted in the early 2000s, and Mikhail Khodorkovsky ended up in prison, and he's still there yet.
But first, the Pakistani Prime Minister Yusuf Raza Gilani is due to appear at the Pakistan Supreme Court on Thursday to face contempt of court proceedings. The court has accused the government of ignoring a ruling that it should write a letter to the Swiss authorities requesting the reopening of a corruption investigation into President Asif Ali Zardari. From Islamabad, Owen Bennett-Jones reports.
The court hearing is the latest manifestation of the pressure on the government from both the judiciary and the military. Prime Minister Gilani and his colleagues are now frequently denounced for alleged corruption, incompetence, and for having tried to involve the United States in the tension between the civilian government and the army. At the Supreme Court hearing, the Prime Minister faces a choice. He can be defiant or conciliatory. Most analysts are not expecting defiance, which could lead to a rapid political crisis. The former cricketer turned politician Imran Khan has for one said that he will mobilise his increasing street power if the Prime Minister challenges the court, and the court, as he put it, needs protection. The legal and verbal clashes at the top of Pakistani politics have been going on for months. So far, the government has remained united and emerged stronger than many expected. The Supreme Court hearing is the next event that could affect its ability to withstand the forces arraigned against it.
Owen Bennett-Jones reporting. New figures from the World Health Organization suggest that nearly half of all abortions performed around the world are unsafe, with the vast majority carried out in the developing world. Africa was particularly affected, with almost 50% of the deaths from botched terminations occurring there. The study into induced abortion, published today in The Lancet, has been tracking trends over a period of 12 years, as we heard from the author, Gilda Sedge.
The overall abortion rate worldwide has stalled out after a period during which the abortion rate had been decreasing globally. Between 1995 and 2003, the abortion rate had fallen from about 35 to 29 abortions for every 1,000 women of reproductive age. And that rate has held fairly steady, so that by 2008, there were still 28 abortions for every 1,000 women.
So by stalled out, you mean it sort of reached that lower plateau and maintained it.
But it's not reached a very low level.
Right.
Yes. And a rate of 28 translates roughly into close to 3% of all women having an abortion in a given year.
Right. That is extraordinary. So what led to the drop in numbers, and what do you think led to that stabilizing at that unsatisfactory level?
The decrease we had seen earlier corresponded with an increasing trend in contraceptive prevalence during that same period of time. And contraceptive levels have also plateaued. That is, the level of contraceptive use in the 2000s.
What must be really difficult, though, is assessing the different cultural inputs, religious, social, economic, all the different things that inform a woman's decision or lack of option in some case.
There are fewer abortions where the laws are liberal than where the laws are restrictive. So you're talking about the context in which they're taking place, and the abortion law doesn't seem to be influencing whether or not a woman seeks an abortion. Mm. The vast majority of abortions are unsafe in regions where abortion laws are restrictive. It's often the case that these are also developing regions, but even in developing countries, when a law is liberalized, we see that fewer and fewer women suffer from deaths and in health from unsafe abortion. So, for example, within Africa, the abortion rate has held steady at a fairly high rate across the continent. But one exception is Southern Africa, where it's the only part of Africa where the abortion rate has really fallen in the past 15 years or so. And more of those abortions are safe. And it looks like what happened is after the abortion law was liberalized in the country of South Africa in 1997, providers were trained in how to do abortions, and public facilities started providing abortions. And the numbers of women who died from unsafe abortions fell by 90% within 3 years after the law was changed.
Let's contrast that then with mm-hmm. another example.
We've done research, for example, in Nigeria and in Burkina Faso. And in Burkina Faso, about 4 out of every 10 women who seek an abortion go to an untrained provider or try to do the abortion themselves or with the help of a friend. And we hear stories in large numbers. And in fact, we have conducted surveys and found that these kinds of situations are happening in large numbers where women are taking toxic substances, they're drinking cleansers, they're inserting foreign objects into their bodies like tree branches and broken Coke bottles, trying to end a pregnancy.
How likely is it that when you present information like this, governments in countries like Burkina Faso and Nigeria will say, that South African model seems preferable. Why don't we train, make legal, make safe this process?
Some have speculated that there is a trend toward liberalization of abortion laws across the world. So since about 1997, 17 countries have liberalized or relaxed the restrictions under which abortion is allowed, whereas only 3 countries have imposed more restrictions. We think that this finding that there are not fewer abortions where the law is restrictive suggests that restrictive abortion laws are not having the impact that they want.
Gilda Sedge. On Thursday, the Arab League monitoring team will deliver their report on the uprisings in Syria. What they say will influence what the world does next. The UN says about 400 people have been killed in the last 3 weeks, on top of an earlier estimate of more than 5,000 killed since March. Tim Hewell has spent the last week in the country observing the observers, and yesterday he went with them to a small town on the outskirts of Damascus, from where he sent this report.
In the streets of Kiswe, the Arab League monitors have immediately attracted a crowd of protesters. I've just heard someone shouting, "People of Kiswe, what are you waiting for? The monitors are here!" At last, people feel there's a force from the outside world that might be able to help them. And the expectations are so great that the monitors, in their distinctive white baseball caps and orange bibs, some of them are from Qatar, some from Kuwait, are being carried now on the shoulders of young men in the crowd. Suddenly, I'm accosted by a university student, he's too scared to show his face, who speaks good English.
When I speak to you, the government will kill my brother because the people want freedom. No one have any weapon, no one have gun, just we have our sound. There is no terrorist here. The only terrorist here is Bashar Assad. Now, I am sure when you go out from Al-Kiswa, they will come to here to punish us and kill us.
What do you want the world to do? Do you want foreign intervention in Syria? Do you want a foreign army in Syria?
I don't need Russia. I don't need Iran. I don't need America. I don't need British.
So what do you want from the Arab League now? What do you want from them?
I think they will not help us anything. He do everything for Libya. He do everything for Tunis, for Egypt, and now for Yemen. But Syria, no. No. Why? Why? Why?
The monitors are moving off now, and almost instantly, the crowd disperses. They're too scared to stay on the streets. At the end of the road, there are soldiers waiting at a sandbanked emplacement. There's a gun trained on exactly where the demonstrators were standing. The observers are committed to getting both sides of the story, and they stop to talk to the colonel in command of the unit, Mohammed Hassan Dayoub. He's got a very different version of events.
They don't really know what they're doing. They don't know what they want. They're being incited by armed gangs.
These holes that we have seen in shutters, in walls, these are holes from bullets from government snipers.
The government never shot anyone in the street. It was armed gangs that did it. The army is in Kiswe to protect the citizens.
The monitors write down a few last notes, then they climb back in their car and speed back to Damascus. Tomorrow, we should find out what the mission has reported back to its bosses in the Arab League. In the meantime, I asked the British ambassador to Syria, Simon Collis, what he thinks the outside world can do to end the violence here.
Well, there's currently a stalemate. We have an Arab League mission currently in Syria, whose job is to not just observe, but oversee the implementation of a plan which the Syrian authorities themselves agreed to. And that plan offers a route to a political solution, but only after the conditions for that have been created, and they are the withdrawal of heavy armour, the release of all political prisoners, an immediate end to all violence, and full access by Arab and international media, by journalists. None of those things have happened in full, and some of them, it seems, haven't happened at all.
What chance of success, then, do you still give the Arab League mission? Because there is simply no other form of outside intervention that's possible.
I think that's right, up to a point. The ability for Europe or other countries in the world to influence events in Syria is limited, and it's important to be honest about that and clear about that. There are things that we cannot do. What we have done is to use our influence internationally in the Security Council and elsewhere to try and press the regime to take the steps it needs to take for a political solution.
And that's the most that the West can do, because in the end the Russians call the shots.
The Russians have a very important position here. They vetoed a draft Security Council resolution which Britain and France prepared earlier last year. By exercising that veto, they reduced international pressure on the regime and gave it some space to continue doing what it's been doing. That's regrettable. It's certainly the British government's hope, and that of the French government and others in the Security Council, that we will be able to go back to the Security Council soon to produce a resolution that will exercise real pressure on the regime. And the Russian position on that will be important, yes.
How worried are you that this is all descending into war?
Well, it is a worry, and there is a real risk of that. The longer this goes on, the greater the violence has become. We don't support violence from any quarter. As for external military intervention, which some people in the opposition have been calling for, that is not going to happen. The situation in Syria is very different from the situation in Libya. Apart from anything else, there is no prospect of a Security Council resolution authorising that kind of operation, and we are not seeking that.
Tim Hewell reporting. You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And you can also post a message on the BBC World Service Facebook page. That's facebook.com/BBC World Service. The U.S. State Department has formally recommended the rejection of a controversial pipeline carrying crude oil from Canada across the United States. The 2,700-kilometer Keystone XL pipeline project had already been delayed after protests against the exploitation of Canada's oil sands by environmental groups. Canada's Minister of Natural Resources, Joe Oliver, gave me his reaction to the decision.
We are very disappointed. We had hoped that this approval process would have been completed by now because, in our view, it's in the interest of both our countries, both Canada and the United States.
But surely it doesn't come as a surprise. The writing seemed to have been on the wall for some time now.
Well, we were, of course, aware of reservations and you know, we understand that this of course, is a presidential prerogative, but we nevertheless felt that the other reasons were, you know, were very important in making the final determination. For Canada, of course, the issue of market diversification has now a even greater urgency.
This would have created many jobs for Canadians and for Americans as well. And given the current economic situation, you really can't wait for the United States to, you know, get its act together, if you like. Are you going to look east? Is perhaps consider a pipeline going to China?
Well, this is exactly what we are looking at. It is a fundamental strategic objective of our country to diversify our customer base. And to do that, we need to build infrastructure, which is to say pipelines to move the oil and gas from primarily from northern Alberta to the coast of British Columbia and on by tanker to Asia. I was recently in China, and our Prime Minister Harper is going to China very soon. There is an enormous complementarity between our two regions on this issue. We're looking to diversify our customer base, and they're looking to diversify their sources of energy supply. So there's a great appetite in China. It's the largest consumer of energy in the world, as you know, and is growing at a very rapid rate. So China, Japan, and some of the other countries in Asia are an obvious market.
Canada's Natural Resources Minister, Joe Oliver. The IMF says it needs to increase its resources by $500 billion to help stabilize the global economy. In fact, that's only half of the anticipated requirement, up to $1 trillion over the next few years. More on where the cash might come from in a moment, but who do they anticipate will receive the funds? Mark Weisbrot is co-director at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington.
Well, it depends what happens to the world economy, but I think the Eurozone is definitely going to be the main recipient of any money from the IMF. It's already got 57% of the loans outstanding from the IMF, and that's where the epicenter of the trouble is.
And where would the IMF be best to turn for these funds?
Well, that's a tough call, because if you have a recession, you're going to have a lot of countries worried about having enough reserves in case things go bad. I don't know that there is a good place. I think they'll go to the United States, they'll go to Europe, and they'll go to Japan, as they did in 2009. And they'll try the BRICS countries, but I don't know that they'll get very much from them.
Is there anything in it for Canada, say? You mentioned Japan, too. Just looking aside from the BRICS for a second, those countries that have given in the past, they're going to talk about it at the G20. Anything in it for them, or is it pouring good money after bad?
I think it's a mistake, because I think they should... First of all, the most reasonable solution is to have the European Central Bank do its job, because if they were to do their job, then you wouldn't have this unsustainable debt burden in Europe.
So just fill out for us what the European Central Bank could do by way of doing its job, as you put it.
Well, first they have to restructure the Greek debt, but Greece is small. That's just a small percentage of even the available funds that they have. To restructure that debt would be very easy. They have to push down the interest rates on the Italian and Spanish bonds, and that they can do simply by buying them and making a commitment. They can just say, well, we're not going to let the Italian 10-year bond rate go over 3.5%, and they can do that.
This insistence on austerity, reform processes, and bailouts reminds me of those structural adjustment programs that were inflicted on African nations at the end of the 80s. Is that a fair precedent? In which case, did it work then?
Well, no, it's never worked anywhere, really. And yes, it is very similar to what they've been doing to middle-income and low-income countries for decades. And it did have, I mean, you know, that's why you had such slow growth. One of the main reasons you had such slow growth in Latin America and Africa, you had negative per capita growth from 1980 to 2000. Those were two lost decades for most developing countries, really. And that was the IMF and those policies that you described as structural adjustment. They don't use that term anymore because it got so discredited. But yeah, that's what they did. Now, in those countries, you could at least make an argument. It was a very weak argument. It was a wrong argument. But you could make an argument that that was necessary because those countries didn't have the foreign exchange that they needed. And so the IMF was giving them foreign exchange in return for policies that made their economies worse. And in this case, you have a central bank for the European, for the Eurozone that has all the money it wants and can print all the money that it needs. And so there's really no excuse for it at all.
Mark Weisbrot, director at the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington. What's happening to politics in Russia? Why is the country's third richest man, who owns a top U.S. basketball team, running for president? 46-year-old billionaire Mikhail Prokhorov is among the many hopefuls who submitted 2 million signatures to the Central Election Commission on Wednesday.
We have collected more signatures than was requested. We filtered these signatures using two different methods. I don't see any grounds of being rejected from registration. After filtering the initial list, we had to get rid of about 10%. So the Central Election Commission's job is almost done. I'm confident that all these signatures are absolutely accurate.
So the billionaire officially entered the presidential race. Is this a new trend in Russian politics? Lise Doucette spoke to Natasha Grand, a Russia expert from the think tank, the Institute for State Ideologies.
It's actually only the second case. The first one was attempted in the early 2000s, and Mikhail Khodorkovsky ended up in prison, and he's still there yet. So I wouldn't call this a particular trend. It is quite a new development, and I don't see any other oligarchs following Prokhorov's footsteps at the moment.
But given what has happened to Khodorkovsky, and who knows when he'll ever get out of prison, does he know he's risking his business interests by entering the race? Or is this now, given what's been happening and the opposition around Vladimir Putin, is this a new time?
It is a new time. Russia indeed has changed over the last years, and the protests against the very dubious parliamentary election results in Russia last December have given Prokhorov the confidence that he cannot be simply silenced as Khodorkovsky was. And again, unlike Khodorkovsky, he has a bigger public profile at the moment, and he speaks to the voters much more than Khodorkovsky ever did. So in that sense, Prokhorov is more secure, of course.
But will he be a serious challenge to Vladimir Putin?
I think that's the question of the day, and that's the question many Russians are asking themselves. A successful businessman, why would he have to bother with going into politics? And there's a lot of conversation about him being somehow linked to the Kremlin. I think given his record, he's the most daring, if you like, of the Russian oligarchs. He's the youngest, he's the one who has tried the most adventurous enterprises, and I think he has the biggest chip on his shoulder with the Kremlin of the ones who are still in Russia and free. He was very impolitely ousted as the head of a liberal party just several months ago. So he does have a chip on his shoulder, and it is plausible to believe that he actually does want to engage in politics, and politics is the next thing for him to do.
But you say he seems to have a reputation, but does it go beyond elite business circles? Would he have a popular standing?
At the moment, we're looking at having seven presidential candidates in the upcoming race. And Prokhorov is the only one who is, if you like, a fresh face with a national recognition. All the others are heads of parties which have been there for ages and which have run into three or four presidential races, been unable to harness any significant degree of popular support. So eyes will certainly be on him. But the question is indeed whether he's committed for a long enough time. I think he himself realizes that his real election is not this upcoming March one, but the one which will come after that one.
Natasha Grand, Russia expert from the think tank, the Institute for State Ideologies. In America, the organizers of the Oscars have released the list of nine films in contention for this year's Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. The list ranges from an Iranian drama, already much praised around the world, to a film recreating a little-known episode of Taiwanese history. More from our arts reporter, Vincent Dowd.
A Separation, directed by Asghar Farhadi, is the best-reviewed Iranian film for some time. Many critics thought the story worked both as domestic drama and as an insight into Iran today. Despite its strong cinematic tradition, Iran has never won the foreign language Oscar, but A Separation must be in with a real chance. No dance film has ever taken the award either, so if Wim Wenders wins with Pina, it will be a departure. Pina explores the work of German choreographer Pina Bausch, who died in 2009, and it's attracted audiences who normally wouldn't go anywhere near modern dance. The foreign language Oscar isn't chosen like other Academy Awards. 63 nations this year submitted a film, and that list was whittled down to these 9. It will now be cut to a final 5. Even getting this far may mean a lot to a film little noticed internationally, like the Taiwanese Warriors of the Rainbow. It's set in an era few will know much about, the resistance of Aboriginal people to the Japanese presence in Taiwan in the 1930s, whereas In Darkness, from Polish director Agnieszka Holland, tackles a topic much seen on film, the Holocaust.
Od samego początku pod moim nosem ukrywa się dole! Zdradziłeś mnie!
Zostawiam życie swoje.
A group of Jews in Lvov hides from the Nazis in the sewers. A Catholic helps them for the money, but what will he do when that cash runs out? There are Oscar shortlisted films too from Belgium, Canada, Denmark, Israel and Morocco, and the winner will be known at the big ceremony on February the 26th.
Vincent Dowd reporting. And that's all from us for now, but an updated version of the Global News podcast will be available for you to download later today. I'm Komla Dumo. Until next time, goodbye.